Well, good evening. My name is Peter Berg, and I'm Assistant Director for Special Collections. And I would like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writer Series. Our guest tonight is Conrad Hilberry. Conrad Hilberry grew up in Michigan. He earned his BA at Oberlin College and his MA and PhD at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, and taught at Kalamazoo College until his recent retirement. Hilberry has published several collections of poetry. He was poetry editor of Passages North and edited the anthology Poems from the Third Coast. His most recent books of poetry are Player Piano, Louisiana State University Press, Taking Notes on Nature's Wild Inventions, Snowy Egret Press, Sorting the Smoke, New and Selected Poems, University of Iowa Press, which was the 1990 winner of the Iowa Prize, and his latest chapbook, The Fingernail of Luck, published by May Apple Press in 2005. And as Mr. Hilberry is showing, he's brought several of these books here that are available for sale after the reading. Mr. Hilberry will read for about 45 to 50 minutes, and at that, when he's finished, the reading will be over with, but he'll be more than happy to answer any questions that you might have afterwards. And of course, I'm sure he'd be happy to sign any books that you might purchase. So will you please join me in welcoming Conrad Hilberry to the Michigan Writer Series.
Thank you. All right, how about some poems? this collection, the poems here have something in common, as you'll see shortly. The first one is called Oboe, and the oboe does the talking. And as you'll see, the oboe is talking to the person who's playing the oboe. Your lips move moist around my double reed, and I feel the sad wind rising through your throat. Some child of yours is lost. If I were your psychiatrist, I'd listen, nod, prescribe. Instead, I take your breath, shape it, let it find a passage down this wooden shaft, curl out around the ankles of the clarinet. The horns have forged a monumental fountain on the stage, and now the strings supply the water, surging up, looping, falling in great sobs. The audience is weeping, but you and I have doubts. We wind our fiber through the latticework of their grand art, hoping someone may hear the muscle twist of grief that's seasoned in a narrow tube, the hollow music of a long-held breath. So that's what the oboe has to say. And in case you were wondering, here's what the poker is thinking about. at the beginning here, the poker sort of looks enviously at the tongs that can do a little bit more than a poker can. And you remember that Prometheus, the god, tossed fire down to earth. Okay, that's the illusion that comes in here pretty soon. Poker. Tongs open up into a laugh, remembering they caught the live coal in their jaws when Prometheus first tossed it down. Somewhere they roast an ox, keep up the fire. And me? For a while I poked some logs. Now I slouch here in the corner, watching the cabin give itself to squirrels and roaches. The spider I think of as my soul climbs the cold chimney pipe, finds it tarred at the roof, spins out a line, drops back down. That's my spiritual adventure. You might think the boys in some back room would honor me when they deal out their pairs and flushes. I could suggest a ritual. Whenever a hand goes straight, they might think of me, the unbent iron. They might take off their hats. No chance. I'm dust and ashes, rust. If I could find my heart, I'd pierce it, run it through. So that's the sad poker. But the cherry pie has something else to say. It really pays to listen to these objects to figure out what they've been thinking and feeling all this time. Here's the cherry pie. We're all acquainted with the airy crowd. A stalk of celery dipped in cottage cheese, a thimble of soy milk, a few green grapes. I invite them over here. Between two butter crusts, my sour flesh so deeply sugared it astounds the mouth. To coax it all to bed, a downy pillow of whipped cream. Try me, you organics. Light the oven. Let me show you how the juices leap when nature shares the sheets with art. And, well, there are a lot of these. Some of you are writers. Here's one spoken by the quatrain, the four-line form. And the poem, too, of course, is spoken in four-line units with the second and fourth lines rhyming. Quatrain. There's Villanelle walking around, retreating, a small bell echoing on each ankle. Perched on the power line are seven haikus, introspective, wan, each one remembering a certain cherry tree or golden carp or thread of water down a rock. And there's Sestina in the park shelling peanuts for her six tame squirrels. Each one takes a nut and stays for the next stanza. Tall in the evening light stands Sonnet under the courthouse pillars, 14 steps above the street. Me, I never settled down. I rattle on through town, waving to Bonnie Barbara Allen, my old acquaintance, still alive, pacing the graveyard. My track curves below the free verse runnels, each one trying hard to be a river. My wheels clack over the ties, the rusting rails. I take it slow, knowing I'm crammed with crates of paint and pistols, bales of fodder, motors that breathe oxygen and oil. I am a box, hitched to a box, hitched to a box. Snaking across the territory, switched off the main line, bridging, tunneling, turning up. I see the dock and depot waiting to take me in. They forget I'm rolling stock. Well, a few more of these. Here's the alarm clock, for example. I'm here, indoor cricket clicking you to sleep. Our pulses, 60 even, straighten out the night. I wake you, four quick beeps, though I'd rather watch you roll and murmur through some urgent dream. Your thank you is to blip me on the head, male hormones coming on at dawn out of some ancient cave. Evolution has its say, I guess. I forgive you that. I know we're different species, but I can't resist. I keep offering my open face, my nightly whisper by your unshaved cheek. No luck. That woman slips under your sheet, and I ache here on the windowsill. I know I should hunt out a mate of my own kind, your shaver, maybe. I can't do it. I'm cursed with an unnatural affection. So, well, let's see. Maybe just one more of these. This one is negative space talking. You know, sculptors talk about negative space. Whatever isn't their bronze or clay or marble or whatever, wherever the marble isn't, that's negative space, and it's part of the whole composition according to the sculptors. The negative space is talking. Where the body isn't, that's how dancers know me. Sculptors bend their clay and steel against my emptiness. Somehow, though I'm not giving it a thought, I nudge a shadow from a twist of bronze or change the way a breast and elbow size each other up. Writers like to wrap white space around their wit, but I'm not white, not bound or folded. I'm your zero with its circumference erased, an abandoned building once the building's gone. Let's say a heavy childhood event has bent your life, shaped what you've become. Now you find it never happened. Nothing there at all. That's me. So that's negative space talking. We might come back to a few more of those. I don't know. I find them attractive, just listening in to some of these objects that have been around all this time. maybe a few nature notes, you might say. I sat in on a colleague's ethology class a few years ago. This is animal behavior. And while the other students were looking for elaborate chains of development of different species and whatnot, I was just looking for odd things that animals can do. And there are some really miraculous ones. Let me read just a few of these. Here, for example, are the facts about the European starling. And I made it look as though it were a poem, but really, it might almost be just a little handing you some information about European starlings. The starlings spend their summers in northern Europe, feeding, breeding, hatching eggs. Then in the fall, they head southwest to milder weather on the English Channel. Wondering how migration works, a birdman fills two cages with autumnal birds in Amsterdam, stashes them in the van, and drives them south to Switzerland. This is what he actually did. In one cage are older birds that made the Channel trip the year before. In the other are the innocents, a few months old, who've never ventured much beyond their nests. In Switzerland, where none of them has been before, he sets them free. The veterans circle, look baffled, then somehow read the continent and head northwest to find familiar shelter on the Channel. The first year birds, with nothing to go on but some built-in compass, head southwest to where the Channel ought to be. They find themselves in Spain, a congenial habitat neglected by their species up to now. They like it there. They stay. It's the truth. Isn't that amazing what migrating birds can do? here's one. The fly. This one gets a little bit beyond the literal flies, as you'll see. Embedded in redundancies, we find it hard to believe. One source of information, one response. A fly, sucking the juice of roadkill, feeds until its crop is swollen, bulging. The crop is the organ where all the juice is stored there. Feeds until its crop is swollen, bulging. Then a single nerve flags down the brain. Enough already, stop. And what if that nerve is severed? We want to tell the fly, wait, use a few facets of your compound eye. Look back at that enormous bladder dragging there behind you. What do you think that weight is bending your hind legs down? But no, the fly keeps on feeding and the crop explodes. We feel superior. We would have noticed even if one nerve were cut. But then we think of instances our species too. We put our head down in the roadkill, taste the juice, feed and feed until our crop explodes. That's a political poem. It's also true about the fly, and these biological experimenters like to do things like snipping one nerve to see what happens. Well, it's been really, really cold. We almost feel as though winter's here, and it's not really here the way it's going to be in this poem that I'm reading. This is called Blizzard of 99. And in this poem, it's really cold, but we sort of have had a foretaste of it, so this might be an okay moment to read this poem. A red ball in among the globs of snow in the wild black cherry. Some kid's hat blown up there by the storm. I go out to look. A cardinal, puffed up, bright red, moving his head a bit to prove he's alive. How can he be? It's 9 below out here, bitter, sunless. Surely there must be fluid in his veins, his toes cramped around that icy branch. Why isn't he frozen up? I know, he's burning calories in there inside his red down jacket. A tiny stove, he's got a fire going, tossing in a molecule of fat whenever it burns low. But stand out here with me for half an hour, holding barehanded to a limb, and then let's hear the explanation one more time. And just one more of these animal poems. This is called Hippocampus, about the miraculous thing that chickadees can do and that Clark's nutcrackers can do. And then it gets to talking about people. In a day, a chickadee can cruise the neighborhood and hide 300 seeds in crevices, in bark or moss, never a spot he's used before. Weeks later, hungry, he looks, remembers, finds the seeds, and eats. Better yet, Clark's nutcracker in the fall can dig 9,000 holes in a hillside, hide pine seeds in each, and cover up each cache. His memory, specifically the hippocampus, will hold 8,000 of those indistinguishable spots and feed him through the winter and the spring. What about another species, us? Not so good at stashing and recalling, but on a city street, we pass 1,000 faces, all looking straight ahead behind their scarves, and in a dreaded instant, recognize the one we hoped had gone to Istanbul. Or glimpsed obliquely through the snow, a twist of hair and forehead that we almost married. Even in a reckless photograph of 16 sepia girls a century ago, we can pick out the face we came for. Our hippocampus must be weighted down with slopes and shadings, eyebrows, noses, cheeks, half-parted lips, a bit of ear, configurations of our fears and loyalties and longings, seeds we hide away and feed on week by week, all winter long. It is remarkable, our ability to distinguish faces. A huge crowd of people, all the same age, all looking exactly alike, you might say, but we know that one right over there. Amazing. maybe a little bit of Latin America. This one is called Mario. It's not set in Latin America. It's set in a classroom like this one up here. But you'll see that Mario isn't from around here. Mario. How did he get in Portuguese 202? He's from Brazil. He speaks Portuguese, a Brazilian kind of Portuguese, folding in some rainy toucan calls. Do you object? Well, he makes the rest of us seem, but he charms us. The syllables run like vines in a baffling forest where we've never been. His eyes look down from the canopy. When he's called to the blackboard, his letters have curious tales like fibry strands of meaning coming loose. He sits on one side toward the back, looks out at the starlings bobbing and strutting on the grass. What birds is he imagining? His eyes settle on us one by one, a tuft of jungle feathers landing on a branch. We come to class early, wanting to feel the humidity change when Mario walks in. Don't listen to Mario, the professor says, but we do. His talk throatier, slurred, faint drums and hungry insects underneath the ornate Lisbon churches in the text, the situation at the travel desk, the doctor's office. Mario is what we came for, we now believe. We lose verbs and pronouns somewhere in the underbrush. We may fail the course. Students, students, the language has rules, conventions, idioms. Mario does not resist. He studies, takes the test. But we can't seem to hold on to the bank. We slip into some tributary of the Amazon, slow swirls and eddies, silt of a continent drifting toward the sea. And in our ears, Mario's dark Portuguese, snakes tangled in tree roots, bats dodging and darting, now that it's nightfall, out of the cave of his mouth. Mario. In a different mood, a poem called Tepoztlan. This is a town in Mexico. Where they have an unusual custom. At the time of the Day of the Dead, equivalent of our Halloween, on the Day of the Dead, people go out to the cemeteries and have sort of a picnic lunch out there by the stone of whoever's in the family has died. And also people in their houses build little altars and set out things for the dead person that they're celebrating. Or maybe something that person liked to eat, or some article of clothing or something there to sort of sanctify the moment and the memory. And in the town of Tepoztlan, they have an additional custom too. From 12 midnight to 1 in the morning, all the church bells in town are rung, and there will be a lot of small churches sort of spotted all over town, and you get all of these clinking little bells going. It would be quite a little racket there from 12 to 1 in the morning. That's what the poem's about. On the Day of the Dead, when midnight comes, the people here ring all the bells in town so the dead can find their way back home. Some say it works. They come. I imagine one of them, a child, hearing the bells like voices across water, like a small wind stepping from island to island, touching the palms and mangroves, waking a dog curled under the boards of a dock. She moves as the bells call her to her own town, her house, but hesitates outside the window. She sees her younger sisters, women now and married, grown sad, it seems, or harsh or tired. If they saw her, how could they know her? Who would comfort whom? She pauses at the curtain, then comes in, smells the fruits and spices they have set out, touches her doll, her dress. Hears their voices, unmistakable even now. She feels crowded by their large arms, their hair, the smell of garlic and cilantro left from supper. This is what it is to love, she remembers. Teeth, breasts, talk heavy with obligation. She sits with them at the table as they dip empanadas in the red sauce. Three young women and an old one, hungry, worried, holding each other's shoulders, laughing, describing Juan Diego and how he went about to cure his sick horse. The girl moves back to the window and eases the twist of air, which is herself, into the small wind and the thin clatter of bells. She remembers a visit to the north once in deep winter. When she and her mother walked in the snow, it cried under their feet. The cold grabbed her in both arms and squeezed until she could hardly breathe. She was afraid of this terrible affection. What did it ask of her? How could she ever return it? I don't quite know how that trip to the north fits in, but I hope it does some way. That poem is about a Mexican family that I just made up, but like as happens often in poems, I think it's closer to home than it seems. Our oldest daughter was killed in an accident when she was 9 years old, and she has three younger daughters. And so partly this is a projection of some kind of our own experience. I think that happens frequently. maybe one more. As long as we're talking about the Day of the Dead time of year, in Mexico they tend to make skeletons figures for the Day of the Dead out of sugar, and you can find them in the drugstore sort of place. And there's this collection of mariachi musicians, all as skeletons. And so I've got a short poem about them. It's called After Music. The mariachis now are skeletons. Fancy hats still shade their skulls, and vacant mouths fall open, singing. Here on a slab outside the iron fence, I listen. The bone-lipped trumpet shapes the old tune now. Then voices hollow out the words, allá donde vivía. These skeletons are young men, recklessly off-key. Up north, our bones are dour, pinned up for anatomy or bagged in plastic for the coroner. No sugar skulls or fiddles show us how to rattle out the after music. Some of our dead still speak, but solo and sorry and seldom from the pelvis. No high-pitched cry, no rancherita, no bony digits quick on the strings. No wired jaws, still longing after the tongue is gone. So that's after music. as long as we're on music, here are a couple of other musical items. This is called Mstislav Rostropovich. He's a conductor and a cellist. Row J, Top Balcony, Hill Auditorium, Ann Arbor. He was playing a cello concert in Ann Arbor. And we were, the Hill Auditorium, as some of you know, is steep. The acoustics are wonderful. But if you're in Row J, Top Balcony, you're way, way up there. So that's the setting. Far below us, the curved walls converge to a tiny circle of light. In it, a bald man sits, holding a cello between his knees as a father might hold a child. He bows the strings simply, telling a story we all have heard before. We did not know each other, but everyone on the steep bank leans together to follow the words, the working out of the old plot. It is as we remember it, but clearer. Everything told just as it must have happened. The knocking on the door, the gift of a shirt, the flowers, the dark road. He catches the lift or falter of each voice and lets a simile unfold like wood smoke. The action goes as we know it must, tangled in jealousy, the bird lost, the lover's misunderstanding. The story pauses and plummets like water over a rock. Silence. The cellist reaches for a handful of high notes, ourselves in the top balcony. He finds us right where he left us and plays us pure and sweet as a bunch of onions hanging from the rafters. Or one that's different. I guess everything is a little bit different than what comes before. This is called Music. And it begins with a quote from Andrew Marvel, "Music, the mosaic of the air." And I thought that was a really nice metaphor, music, the mosaic of the air. So this poem is written in Andrew Marvel's rhymed pentameter couplets. There are a couple of allusions to actual mosaics later on in here. One of them is Christ as the Good Shepherd. Christ is there with some sheep. And there's another one from the baths of Neptune in Ostia. And in that mosaic, there are dolphins and eels and horses with fish tails and stuff like that. So it's an actual mosaic that the poem alludes to. Okay, this is Music, the Mosaic of the Air. Cornet and cymbal, viol and the choir, those practicing the wind and those the wire, that's a quote from Andrew Marvel, those practicing the wind and those the wire, this the wire and the wind, all place their subtly colored chips of sound just here and here, until three vines have wound their green chromatic stems around an urn, a bunch of grapes, a bird. Where did they learn to master this mosaic of the air? Each marble quarter note is fingered there where its clean edge will catch the echoing light. Another motif now, the shadowed white of fleece, six sheep, and Christ in golden stone, seated, sandaled, lit by an overtone of loss. A solo, a concluding strain, and Christ is gone. Now, scattered blue notes. Rain? No, larger cadences call in the sea itself, and Neptune drives four sinewy fish-tailed stallions through the drumming brine, past dwarfs on dolphins, past the serpentine border of eels, to our mosaic's slow dissolve. We ride the water, but we know the surge that sweeps up dolphins and despair is sound, not stone. A fragile twist of air that sends its viney cipher to the ear, and then, like winter breath, must disappear. The colors fade. An ordinary breeze bends the long grass and shuffles through the trees. Well, we have time for a few more. It's getting along toward Christmas time. Here's a poem called Midnight. It'll be clear what's happening. That boy won't go to sleep, dancing, clowning, chewing the edges of night, until his mother straps him in the car and drives. Glancing patterns, storefronts, Christmas deer outlined in lights, He leans back and seems to concentrate, breathing in the dark where faces disappear. Nothing to be hankered for or lost, no place to go, only gears clutching, second, third, fourth, easing him forward, then back once more. Acceleration all mixed up with gravity. Eyes roll, head tilts, and he's asleep, rocked in the cradle of the motor age. And on the tape, Art Tatum's liquid touch, not loud, syncopated with the wingless flight of streetlights headed south. What sleep has always been, snow-bowed shapes outside a window, a swirl that by morning may be plowed and heaped, but now is shifty, drifting, and blown. The sleeper's fingers stretch and curl as he might reach in a shadowed stream, feeling for weeds, then going under to touch the red fins of the fish that swim the midnight flux of dream. So, kid in a car going to sleep. Okay, let's try this. This will be clear. It's called "Let's Say I'm Sad." Almost before I feel it, I find myself saying it. I'm sad. The feeling's like a shoe tossed out of a rowboat. It floats, then fills, turns, drifts, sinks into the tangle of weeds at the bottom. Right now, I'm shoving that feeling into words, watching it go down as sadness. What would sadness be without the word? I'll step back, let my tongue go limp, and listen from the shore. There it is, the feeling, still as a carp in the muck. If it wants to sulk there, breathing with its fins, fine. Or if it craves, maybe it will muscle up from the cold, breach open-mouthed, and swallow some wet wad of seeds. Whatever, I'm just watching. Go, sadness, find your own way. When we first walked upright, before we talked, hunger must have been a huge unopened need, sadness vague and dark as the watery shadow of a rock. No place for carp, the word carp, my hook to reel the blurred grief in. I don't know if that's clear or not, but it's really strange to think what our feelings would be like if we didn't phrase them, you know, if we didn't translate them into words. And even when I try to picture this sadness as a carp at the bottom of the ocean, just doing whatever it wants, still there's the word carp there that I'm supplying and sort of reeling in that feeling by the words I apply to it. Maybe the place to go from here is to a few more of these. Are you good for a few more talking objects? We could finish up with them. Here's one I haven't read very often. It's called Hunch. We talk about having a hunch. And it's the hunch that's speaking here. Never mind the safe municipal that claims to offer 3.8% for 15 years. Forget the charts that promise you the intracoastal channel when the tide goes out. No memorizing everything the deck has dealt. Just follow me in the tall grass swale here by the woods. See the way the sun gets broken in that patch of swamp. The way that droop of juniper makes a doorway to the dark. Soon you'll hear the insect's smooth roulette clicking out your name. Inside this mound I carry on my back, some ancient bones are buried, a trove where lowlife stirs, where larval broods ferment and generate. Put your hand here where my humped shoulders bend to the ground. Feel the current? That's the fingernail of luck, crawling up your arm. After having written the poem, I found in the dictionary a definition of the word hunch, and it said that it came to mean, just a lucky feeling, because people believed that if they put their hand on the back of a hunchback, they would have some sort of intuition, or they would guess right, you might say. So isn't it nice to put them both into a poem? Let the hunch end up with the hunchback. Here's the mouse trap. My parents were mouse traps, and my grandparents, an ancestry of wood and wire. I knew my trade. You should have seen me half a century ago. Cocky. Build a better mouse trap, someone would say. I'd look him in the eye. Some things are what they are, I'd say. Can you build a better guillotine? The blade falls, gravity with edge. Want to try a circular saw? That was the way I talked back then. Now I waste here on the shelf behind the decon. No offspring, end of the line. Still, after midnight, I can feel my wire go taut against the headboard. My curled hips ready. I wait, pretend to sleep. When something chews the cheese between my legs, everything I've stored breaks free. The job is done, done right. I draw a breath, lean back, sleep out the night. And here's an electric collar. You know, people who want to keep their dog from running outside the yard, they put a collar around the neck of the dog. Okay, it's the collar talking. I'm the cop you've hired to enforce your petty ordinance. Whenever Jesse races toward the street beyond the planted wire, I have to shoot these bolts of fire to her throat. But I love that six-month hound. All day I rub the soft hairs of her neck, and she murmurs news of everything under the leaves and on the wind. These shocks, as if someone made you whip your daughter for roller skating in the park. I have a plan. Tonight, I'll burnish up my brass, unwrap my arms from Jesse's neck, and snake my way into your jewelry box. While you're considering an item to set off your blouse, I'll curl my languid leather underneath your hand. You'll take me to your throat, a Gucci touch, discreetly punk. Then we'll step out, high fashion, night air cool and moist, and the streetlight waiting. and finally, the waning moon. I rise at midnight when the first sleep staggers into dream, later and lesser. In a week, I become the dark. My music knows its way to a gnash rusting by a shed, the slow mating of snakes in a creek bed. My half-moon blues, my strum on the two lanes of an empty road, the road you're following beside some dusty milkweed in the fence. I draw my bow across the telephone wires, a thin dirge for your nation, for the end of something wild, broad-backed, generous. Listen for me. With help from the wind, I can pour my six pale notes through the ninth sieve, lend you the cricket's cadence to walk home by. Thanks. Thanks very much. You're very patient. I would have been a little less formal, except that somebody is recording this or whatever, you know. But if there are things you want to say or ask, let's do it. Or feel free to go your way. It's been really nice having you here.
What is it like working with Jane? I put your name into Google yesterday or maybe the day before and saw that you taught a class at Colorado College also.
Yes. Yeah. Do you know Jane?
No. Yeah. I
Oh, my goodness.
Actually, you advised me on my SIP.
Tell me your name.
Dave Mason.
David, of course, yeah. Gosh, you didn't have a beard back then.
Oh, no, I didn't.
Oh, I'm so glad you could come.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, wonderful to see you.
Thanks.
Yeah. Oh, we worked together a lot in the old days, yeah. Yes, Jane is teaching at Colorado College, and at the last minute, somebody who was supposed to teach a creative writing course couldn't come, and she called up and said, well, how would you like to come out here for September? So we did.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Nice place to go.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.